The plan for today is to compute the spectrum of gravitational perturbations of our black brain in at least part of a spectrum. But before doing that, let me say a few words about the elements of relativistic fluid dynamics, because this is something that we'll need to compare it to. And it's a pretty big subject, but we just consider some elements of it. So fluid dynamics or hydrodynamics describes small deviations from thermal equilibrium. From thermal equilibrium. And the equilibrium state is characterized by the density operator. And one of the incarnations of the density operator is the following. So it's normalized in the following way. And let me, so this is nothing but the Gibbs distribution, but written in a slightly unorthodox way. It's gamma A Q A, where P mu is the four momentum. Four momentum and QA are conserved charges. Conserved charges, for example, baryon charge and so on. Maybe some U1 charges. And beta mu and beta mu here and gamma A parameterize the parameterize the manifold of equilibrium states. So beta mu is nothing but the inverse temperature beta times u mu, the four velocity, and gamma A is beta times the chemical potential conjugated to the charge QA. And here the four velocity, as usual, is normalized in the following way, where C will be equal to 1 in the following. So beta is the inverse temperature, and Z is trace of this density operator rho. So this is the equilibrium statistical mechanics written down for relativistic applications, where you have this thing written covariantly. And now if you want to consider deviations, so you can describe, so once you have rho, you can compute trace rho that gives you a partition function Z, and from that you compute the free energy and all thermodynamic quantities as usual. So some free energy F is equal to minus T or log Z, or you can, if you consider chemical potentials, so typically this will be some generalized function usually called omega potential. Sometimes other terminology is used, but that's the point. So this is just equilibrium statistical mechanics in relativistic form. So note that, of course, the number of conserved charges could be fairly large, right? So you can have many chemical potentials in the game depending on how many conserved charges you have. But what we want to consider is the deviations of this equilibrium. So we have the laws of thermodynamics, including the zero flow of thermodynamics, which tells you that the temperature is uniform throughout the system. There are no fluxes, nothing flows anywhere. Everything is dead completely, right? So this is the timeless world. Now, if we want to consider deviations, so suppose we have deviations from equilibrium, then we have to consider the situation where our velocities, chemical potentials, and temperature would have some, will acquire some dependence on x and t, right? That means that the deviation from equilibrium simply means that the temperature here, for example, is slightly higher than the temperature here, and therefore you would expect some flux of energy, or the flux of matter in case if chemical potential would be slightly different, until the whole thing equilibrates, right? So of course one can consider a very large deviation from equilibrium, some turbulence and some rather complicated processes. And that would be a strongly non-equilibrium regime, which we will not discuss here. Our goal is far more modest. We want to discuss very small deviation from equilibrium where this dependence on x is fairly benign. So you have just slightly perturbed your system from equilibrium and you see what happens. You know what happens, namely that there will be some fluxes, for example, fluxes of charge. So you have some currents and or fluxes of heat and so on. And until the thing equilibrates. So you know that it will equilibrate, right? So it will go back to equilibrium. So we'll not discuss any complicated dissipative structures or steady states or anything of the sort. And the language to describe these deviations from equilibrium is effectively the language of fluid dynamics. But we need to remember that we do have conservation laws. Conservation laws, such as the conservation of our energy momentum tensor and conservation of some current involved. And that will be so if you just look at how many components you have in T mu, so you have in D dimensions, you have G plus 1, G plus 2, over two components in D plus one dimensions. And where's the equation conservation gives D plus one equations, right? So this condition is D plus one equations. And the same thing with d mu, j mu equal to zero. So if you add this equation, right, which is a scalar equation, then we have, so this is d plus one equation, but together with this one, we have altogether d plus two equations, but number of components. So for d plus one, so these are coming from T mu, d plus two over two, and these are coming from the current, right? We have d plus one components of the current J mu, and components, right? So it's not obviously not enough, right? So if you just say, okay, so I want to solve these equations, and that would describe me what is happening, that is definitely not the case. So you need some simplifying assumptions, and the simplifying assumption is that in the Hydra regime, simplifying assumption that sufficiently close close to equilibrium the our states are described by d plus two variables, namely temperature as a function of x and t, velocity as a function of x and t, and some chemical potentials, same function. So this is, so you can easily see that that's exactly d plus two variables, and we have d plus two conservation equations. So we need some equations that would describe, and we have, originally we have these number of components, this number of components. So somehow we need a set of equations that would express these extra components apart from these d plus two, the fundamental ones, through the fundamental components written here. Okay, so again, microscopically, right? So microscopically, right? Microscopically, so you have your quantum field theory. For example, you write down Lagrangian, and you can write down explicit expressions for T mu nu and J mu. And microscopically, you have a certain number of variables, namely components of these operators. And the number of these components is fairly large. The number of equations, if we want to think of only of dynamics of these quantities, of these tensors, is the number of equations that govern the behavior of these components is smaller. And we need to, so if we only think about the approach to thermal equilibrium, we need to make a certain assumption in order to match the number of components, number of equations. And it turns out that this assumption gives us exactly what we are looking for. And is it something outrageous? Probably not, because you can think about this in the following terms. At equilibrium, in thermal equilibrium, your system is completely characterized by the conserved charges, right? So like here, right? The equilibrium thermal state is characterized by the collection of conserved charges, right? The total energy, like think of the microcanonical ensemble where everything is conserved, right? When you build a canonical one and then a grand canonical one out of the microcanonical one. So in the microcanonical ensemble, you have a collection of conserved charges, including the total energy. And then you have the chemical potentials, including inverse temperature is one of the potentials which are conjugated to these conserved charges. So in thermal equilibrium, your system is completely characterized. So all microscopic dynamics, right? So all these complicated variables in Schrodinger equation and so on, all of this becomes irrelevant, and your full system completely characterized by the total energy total, angular momentum total, conserved charge, and so on, right? So you reduce all variety of this microscopic dynamics just to the collection of conserved charges, nothing else. And from that, you compute the properties of the system, like free energy, and any component, anything that follows from thermodynamics. Okay, now you take one step sort of from this dead world of thermal equilibrium to something which is still slightly alive, right? So there are some fluxes, right? So something. So in that case, you promote your conserved charges, your quantities, you promote them to something which depends. Well, first of all, it's useful to introduce the density of conserved charge. So, for example, if you have a total charge Q, right, but it's useful to introduce the density, which is Q over, for example, free volume. And this density may become a function of X and T, right? Because as I said, right, so here it could be higher than here, and then you have some flux. So your conserved charges or densities of conserved charges, instead of being constant numbers, right, so just constants, they acquire some non-trivial dependence on coordinates and time. But this dependence is not arbitrary because you remember that you're very close to equilibrium, and the dynamics of these densities of conserved charges is such that they will eventually relax back to the state where all of them are constants. Okay, so this is a special limit, right? This is our assumption, right? That close to equilibrium, sufficiently close to equilibrium, we can describe the system by these densities. Our fundamental variables are densities of conserved charges. Because if we wait a little bit, or maybe a little bit longer, these densities of conserved charges will relax back to being constants. Okay. Now, it is an assumption. It's a plausible assumption. It gives the right result from the point of view of Navier-Stokes equations and so on. But it's not a proof. It's something that you may want to prove, kind of looking at your Lagrangian or Hamiltonian, and people are actually trying to do precisely that. Now, in kinetic theory, this can be explained. So this can be explained more explicitly. And I can probably refer people who are interested in that to original papers by Bogolyubov, because I'm not sure this is written anywhere else with such a clarity. And so they are translated into English. So where you can actually see how if you have a kinetic regime, so if you, for example, if you're talking about slightly, for example, non-ideal gas, right, and or some system which is dilute, and you can have a small parameter where you can use equations such as Boltzmann equation, then you can actually see how this hydro limit emerges from that dynamics explicitly. Not only Bogolyubov, of course. I mean, there are many people who contributed to that, but the reference that I like is his papers of 1946 and later. But we're not going to prove that or go into kinetic theory. We'll take this as a working assumption and we'll see what happens. So again, our fundamental degrees of freedom are these ones. There are d plus two of them, but we have many more degrees of freedom. And we have to write down some equations that express these other degrees of freedom through these fundamental d plus two ones. So these are called constitutive relations. And let me give you a very simple example. So suppose we are talking about conserved charge. So this is d naught j naught plus di ji equal to zero. And our fundamental variable in hydro regime is the density of conserved charge, J naught. That's the philosophy there, right? So this density of conserved charge eventually will relax to something constant, J naught equal to constant in equilibrium. But we want it to be alive for a time being. So it depends on X and T. But we have also other components of J mu. We have other three components. And we need to write down, so we need to express Ji through J naught somehow. So this is called the constitutive relation. And you can write this constitutive relation in a fairly natural way, right? So so this is so you need Ji as a function of J naught, right? So you need to write the expression that would be, first of all, consistent with the symmetries of your variable, right? So if you have an index I, the right-hand side better have index I. And if you have something, some density which is a scalar quantity, how to get the index I, you need to take a derivative, right? So that's what you can do. So this is sometimes called derivative expansion. Now, so you write down this term, right? So this is physically this is very well known to you. In fact, it has a wonderful name. It's known as Fick's law, 19th century. Now, but from modern point of view, modern perspective, what you're doing here is you're building your effective field theory by including on the right-hand side all possible operators which are compatible with the symmetries of your problem, right? In this case, you have a vector, so this stuff here, whatever you write here, must have a symmetry of a vector. So there could be nonlinear terms here. There could be higher derivatives involved, right? So you can nothing prevents you from writing down the higher derivative pieces. And in fact, this expansion is, formally speaking, is completely infinite, right? So it's you can write as many terms with as many derivatives as you like. And this is effective field theory expansion. But from physical point of view, of course, the first term here is nothing but the gradient, right? So if you have a density of your charge slightly, for example, this density is slightly higher here and then here, then you expect a current, and the current will be proportional to the gradient, of density of the charge, with some coefficient, unknown coefficient d, which you just put there by hand, because there should be some coefficient, but this is nothing but the diffusion constant. If you combine the conservation equation, and this effective field theory expansion, then what you get is the diffusion equation d naught j naught, right? So it's d to I j naught. So this is nothing but the diffusion equation. And if your j naught has the Fourier expansion of this kind, this dependence, then this means that the dispersion relation will have this form, okay? Where dot 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 correspond to these higher terms, which in principle, yeah.
So here we're working on implied space, right? But
yeah.
I assume that the idea afterwards is going to be promote this into curved space then.
Yes, we can write all of this also in curved space, although that will be of less importance, because ultimately what is happening here is the field theory sort of consideration, right? So we want to consider our, for example, n equals 4 superand mills at strong coupling in flat space. Yes, we can consider it on a sphere or in some curved space in principle, right? I mean, nothing prevents us from doing that. But our basic example will involve n equals 4 at finite temperature and finite density of some charge in flat space. So that's why. So this whole discussion so far is in flat space.
Okay. So the idea is to apply this to the gauge part of this duality.
Exactly. Yeah. Because we are looking at our field theory, generic. Well, you can apply this to n equals 4 super Mills, but of course the idea is that at strong coupling, what you have to compute, right? So what you're interested in, right? So these dispersion relations of this type. Just like in an effective field theory, when you do this expansion in infinite series of operators of various dimensions, so each such term has a coefficient, masses and so on, right? And these coefficients in principle are calculable. So if you have infinite sort of power of calculation, right? So you could derive what these coefficients are, the masses of your theory and so on, from the microscopic physics, from the microscopic Lagrangian. So you integrate out some fields and so on. So usually this is very difficult to do, especially if you don't know the dynamics at higher energies. And this situation is no different. So you can compute the diffusion constant, for example, using, for, let's say, the Boltzmann equation in kinetic theory for weakly interacting system or dilute gas. And that's a huge machinery of kinetic theory. But if you're working with a system which is strongly coupled, right, and you don't have to go to quark-gluon plasma to face this problem, right? So just try to compute the diffusion coefficient for water, right, or viscosity of water, right? So that is microscopically, right? There is no methods how to do that. Simply don't know. Okay. So this is where our dual gravity will come into the game. Okay? So that's the idea. But so far, it's just in QFT, right? So this is, it's no dual gravity or anything. So just in QFT. So you have a dispersion relation of that type for diffusion. And the similar thing happens with the energy momentum tensor. All right, so similarly, you have the conservation equation for stress energy tensor, and fundamental variables in the hydro regime are densities of conserved charges, namely density of energy and density of momentum. Okay, so these are our conserved charges. A different language for them is temperature as a function of x and velocity components, right? There are four velocity u mu, but it is normalized to -1. So the independent components, there are three of them, which is the usual velocity v as a function of x, right? So these are four variables, and here we have four variables. So you can use either these components or these ones. Now, in remember that T mu is in equilibrium has this form, the energy density, and then pressure on the diagonal. This is Pascal's law. If your system is isotropic, right? So if it is not spatially isotropic, then things are more complicated. But let's consider this simplest example. But the pressure is not independent. There is an equation of state which tells you that the pressure is some function of the energy density. So it could be ideal gas, or it could be slightly non-ideal gas. So you have van der Waals equation, or God knows what. But this comes. So this equation of state comes from equilibrium equilibrium thermodynamics. If you're able to compute with Z, if you're able to compute free energy, and once you have free energy, you can compute pressure independently and energy density. And combining these two equations, you can express P as a function of epsilon. Right? For ideal gases, it's trivial. And for van der Waals gases, less trivial, but it's still doable. And of course, in generic cases, it's fairly complicated. But the bottom line is that you still have, so this is the equilibrium expression. Now, so energy density as a function of x and t is this component t naught naught. And we write down t mu nu generically as t mu nu equilibrium, which is given by this expression, plus deviation from equilibrium, which depends on x and time. Then the equation, so the conservation equation, simply can be written down explicitly. And let me write this down. So I will delegate some of this to exercises. But so d naught t tilde, right? So t without tilde does not depend on x and time. So it vanishes, but a derivative of it vanishes. But di of t tilde z naught I is equal to 0. And then we have d naught I plus dj t tilde ij is equal to 0. So again, we know that t naught naught, so to 0 order, t naught naught equilibrium is epsilon t ij. Equilibrium is pressure times delta ij. But we want to, so to first order, so this is if you want a zero order, then so this is zero order in derivative expansion. And then you have the first order. The first order will tell you that t naught naught, now the function of x, is t naught naught equilibrium, this is epsilon, plus t tilde naught naught of x. We already had this equation. And then there is a question of what to do with tij as a function of x, right? So tij was p times, so p is a function of epsilon times delta ij. But then what can you do? So one natural piece that you can write down is the following. So you expand, so this is a function of energy, right? So you you expand it and you write down that this is delta ij dp over d epsilon times t naught naught, right? So t tilde naught naught, which is deviation of delta epsilon, if you want, right? So or epsilon itself. But then it's not the end of the story. Because in principle, you also have, so your variables are not, so this is t naught naught, which depends on x. It's one variable, t naught naught. But you also have t naught I. And you have to write the constitutive relation similar to the one that you had for Fick's law, right? So you need to express tij, right? So all components should be expressed as functions of fundamental variables. And fundamental variables are these ones, and also t naught i tilde, right? So these are our fundamental variables, right? So we need expression which tells us what tij tilde is expressed through these fundamental variables. And this expression is written in the following form. So this is, to some degree, a convention. So 1 over, it's normalized to this thermodynamic variable, energy density plus pressure. And then inside, there is this bracket I will write down and try to explain what this bracket is. So again, you write down something which contains the appropriate number of indices, ti and j. But it is a tensor. And this tensor can be split into independent pieces, right? So here I will write this in d plus one dimensions, although from time to time we'll switch to 3 plus 1. But let's try to be as general as we can. With two independent coefficients, eta and zeta. So what we wrote here is is a tensor which is split into the traceless part and the trace, which transform differently, and they have independent different coefficients, which can be calculable, which in principle should be calculable from the microscopic theory. And for convenience, they are normalized to this epsilon plus p. So there is nothing. And you can just write any coefficient alpha in front of this thing and beta in front of this thing, but it is convenient to normalize them in this way. Okay, plus higher derivatives. Higher derivatives. Derivatives of, again, fundamental variables t naught I and t naught naught. Okay. So this is our expansion to first order in derivatives, right? So this is zero for order in derivatives. And this one, right? So this and this are no derivatives. And then we write down the first order in derivatives. But in principle, you may want to continue this and write down the high derivative terms. So the second order hydro is known, at least, well, perhaps not absolutely fully, but well, maybe fully, I don't know. Sure, if it is written correctly, completely in the presence of charges, I think it has been written even in that case. But the third order hydra, as far as I know, nobody was brave enough to sort of write it down. So it is of some interest. So if you are brave enough, you can do that. Not a pleasant task, but it's doable. Now, we have these constitutive relations written, and the coefficients that enter here are called the shear and bulk viscosities. Shear and bulk viscosity. Now, what you can do, so there are various remarks about this expansion. First of all, I'm not mentioning various. There are situations when you have theories with anomalies, and in that case, there are other terms appear in the constitutive relations, and there are various other complications. So let me just give you some references to look at. So C. Also, so there is this paper of Son and Sorovka where they consider other pieces which are related to anomalous currents, and lecture notes by Kofton, 12.05.50.40. Where you can read various things about these expansions. For our purposes here, it will be enough just to limit ourselves with this simple expansion. Now, an exercise for you is the following, this is really something that I would like you to do. Although for some reason I haven't included this in today's tutorial, but it is an important exercise. So take these expansions, right? So we have a system of equations which come directly from conservation of T minimum. But we now have the expressions for T tilde naught naught, which is just a fundamental variable. T naught I is a fundamental variable. T tilde ij is this whole expression here, apart from the very first term, which is equilibrium value, right? So everything which is beyond equilibrium, namely starting from this term and beyond, is t tilde ij, right? Because, well, the first one simply doesn't depend on x and t, so it's automatically derivative, it's automatically zero, but the rest does depend on x and t. And so take this expansion and substitute into the system of equations, right? So this is a system of equations for, so you need to solve the system of these equations. So exercise, so solve the system of equations which effectively come from conservation law, right, like this, assuming so with the fundamental variables which describe deviation from equilibrium. So assume the dependence of these variables of the form like this. So let's say put the momentum k along the z direction for simplicity, and find the eigenmodes of the system. Right. So what does it mean? This means, so the exercise is the following, right? So take this thing, substitute into the system of equations. You will get a system, a matrix of differential equations for two variables. Well, effectively two variables, in fact, more because it has index I, but let's forget about this I, right? So it will be a matrix system. It will be some differential operators here, right? Acting on T naught I, right, and this whole thing equal to zero, right? And there'll be some stuff here which you can find by substituting into the equation. When you introduce Fourier transform, so do it in Fourier space, then the derivatives with respect to time will be converted to omega, and derivative with respect to z will convert to q as multiplicative variables. And then you have some algebraic matrix acting on these guys equal to zero. So this system of algebraic equations, as you well know, will have non-trivial solutions when the determinant of the system is equal to zero. Okay? So the exercise that I expect you to do is to do the substitution, determine this matrix, let's call it A of omega nq, and then compute determinant of A equal to zero. This computation, right, so determinant of this matrix A omega q equal to zero, you will get the eigenmodes. And these eigenmodes are quite revealing. So eigenmode number one will have the following form. And everywhere, dot, 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 determine all these pieces which we didn't include. So in principle, remember that all these dispersion relations are infinite series in Q. And here, because we have zero chemical potential in this case, thermodynamics tells us that epsilon plus P is equal to S times T, where S is the entropy density, right? So if mu is equal to zero, then you have epsilon plus p equal to st, right? So this can be written as eta over s times t q squared plus higher terms. And the second, so this will be dispersion relation number one. And dispersion relation number two comes from, so you will get a quadratic equation of the following type, omega squared plus I gamma omega q squared minus v squared s q squared equal to zero, where vs is the speed of sound, which is square root of dp over d epsilon, and gamma is this damping constant, which depends on viscosities. It contains the bulk viscosity zeta plus, again, so let me write in d plus one dimension. Hope I'm not, it's coefficient. You better check it, but I think it's correct. So it'll be some combination of viscosities. So this is quadratic equation, which can be solved And so if it happens that the speed of sound is not equal to zero, then you can solve this equation. And well, you can solve it regardless of this condition, of course. But if Vs is not equal to zero, then the dispersion relation for the sound wave that you derive is the following, minus I gamma over 2 Q squared. And then there is this infinite tail, which is sitting here. But in principle, it's not included in this first order hydro. But you might think of what happens in the second order hydro and so on. Right? OK, so this is the fundamental. It is a result of fundamental importance for what we are going to do, right? So this is four-dimensional or d-dimensional, d plus one-dimensional quantum field theory, or in fact any theory you can think of. You know, you can think of water, of gas, of n equals four superatomic minimals, of any theory you want. The assumption is that the theory typically would have this fluid dynamics regime, which is a regime close to thermal equilibrium, where everything is described by constant charges. If you make one step away from this, it is described by densities of conserved charges, which now acquire dependence on x and time. You write down the effective field theory of these densities of conserved charges and derive the eigenmodes, the excitations, the dispersion relation for excitations in those theories. And for excitations which are relevant for charge conservation, your dispersion relation is simply written there, right? So this is a diffusion, this dispersion relation for the diffusion of charge. Now here, if you talk about T mu, then you discover that there are two eigenmodes. One of them is this one. This is typically called the shear mode. The shear mode. And the other one is the sound. So normally people are familiar with the sound. Of course, in any medium, you expect propagation of the sound. And if this medium has a non-zero viscosity, so viscosity, in the physical meaning of viscosity, is the internal friction in your fluid or gas, right? So you have some layers of this fluid or gas. If they move with different velocities, then so sort of the simple picture of viscosity, kind of in terms of kinetic theory, right? So viscosity, shear. Why is it called a shear viscosity? You have some layers, for example, of fluid or gas moving with velocities v1 and v2, right? So you have particles, or think of the kinetic theory, you have particles which move in all possible directions, but they do have also transverse momentum, right? So they move in particular, they can move also between the layers. And the particles which belong to the slower layer penetrating into the faster layer will slow it down, and vice versa. The particles from the faster one will penetrate the lower layer and try to speed it up. Eventually, all of this will equilibrate, right? So that you can think of simple mechanical analogy of this, like people jumping from train to train, right? If you have two trains moving different velocities. But the bottom line is that the shear, so what viscosity describes, this coefficient eta, it describes the transfer of momentum, right, in the direction perpendicular to the direction of the flow. And this is why it's called the shear. So the shear viscosity makes sense only if you have enough dimensions to introduce a shear, right? So you have a slightly different velocities in your layers of your gas or liquid. Okay, and the sound wave are the pressure waves, so that people are typically very well familiar with. And they are damped, so sound will not propagate forever. If you have internal friction in your system, then the sound wave will be damped, and the coefficient of damping will be proportional to shear and bulk viscosities. Fine. So this is our conclusion. And now what we want to see is, as I said, so in principle, you can we had one calculation which we did a long time ago. For conformal field theories, the equation of state was epsilon equal to 3p, and that means that Vs, right? So in CFT in 3+1 dimensions, that the velocity of sound therefore is speed of light divided by the square root of 3, just by equation of state. So this is our prediction. That's what we can predict from fluid mechanics without doing any calculation in the microscopic theory. And if you just know that the theory was conformal at zero temperature, then the speed of sound will be equal to that. But we don't know anything about gamma. We don't know anything about viscosities. Sorry, not quite. I mean, we know that in CFT, the bulk viscosity must be zero. Bulk viscosity must be zero. Take a trace of T mu, right? So this thing multiplies a piece of trace. So it must be zero because trace of T mu must be zero. Okay, so bulk viscosity is zero. Speed of sound is equal to 1 over the square root of 3 in units of the speed of light. This is all we know. And we know the functional dependence. So we know that we have these collective excitations at finite temperature. And these collective excitations manifest. So if we consider a quantum theory, how the collective excitations manifest themselves in the quantum theory, they manifest themselves in computation of the correlation functions. They come as poles, right? So the excitations, the quasi-particles or fundamental excitations, photons, for example, quasi-particles like phonons, they will manifest themselves on a quantum level as poles of the correlation functions in your quantum field theory. Okay? So this is what we expect. And now make a connection with what we discussed in the last lecture. We know how to compute the poles of our correlation functions at strong coupling. We know that all we need to compute is a quasi-normal spectrum of the dual gravity background. Okay? That was a theorem that we discussed last time. So our prediction is that if the duality between, for example, ADS Schwarzschild, type 2B string theory on ADS and n equals 4 super Antmilis is correct, then if we are working in the appropriate limit, right? So important thing is that this is a hydro limit of the theory, and the hydro limit implies that we are close to equilibrium, so we'll discuss this condition in a moment. But if we are working in the appropriate limit, then it is guaranteed that if we compute the quasi-normal frequencies of the dual gravity background, which is given by the ADS-Schwarzschild black hole, then these quasi-normal frequencies must contain in the spectrum can be very complicated, but in this spectrum, you must find frequencies of this type with dispersion relation given by this expression and this one. Okay, this is a prediction. Okay, and now let's see how this prediction actually works in the dual gravity. So before that, so let's think of this condition. When you have the hydro regime, so what it actually means. Let me write down the metric. So now consider. Now consider the hydro limit of ADS CFT, right? So again, so we expect, so expect correlators such as correlator of conserved currents, let's say J mu of K, J nu of minus K at finite temperature, and maybe density, but let's put density to zero for a moment. I mean that will not and T mu nu of K T rho sigma of minus K again at finite temperature, to have expect correlator such as this and this, to have poles at omega equal to minus I d q squared plus so on, omega equal to minus I eta over st q squared so on, omega equal to plus minus vs q minus I gamma q squared plus so on, in the limit, in the limit, then Hydra approximation is valid, right? So in principle, if you compute the correlators, let's say, of two currents, so let me write them as so remember that at finite temperature, so at finite temperature, you have your four momentum k mu, but at finite temperature, as we discussed yesterday, once you have a preferred frame of reference where your temperature is equal to T, right, a heat bath, then you break Lorentz invariance, and instead of covariant expressions k mu, k nu, and so on, you need to write down separately omega and q. So they will not enter as covariant expression anymore because there's no Lorentz invariance at finite temperature anymore. But there is a rotational invariance if you don't want your system to be anisotropic in spatial direction. So then q will be still will belong to the rotational invariant piece, but it will not go together with omega, right? So it will not be k mu squared as in Lorentz invariant case. So I will write down this correlator as a function of omega separately and q, and here j nu of minus omega minus q. So in principle, this is some function. So we will compute retarded correlators, and it will be a rather complicated function of omega and q generically, and the same for Tminu. But we know that in the Hydra limit, this thing, we expect that it has the poles, and moreover, we know what kind of dispersion relation these poles must have. So what is this limit? What is this limit? So in the language of field theory, the fluid dynamics approximation, the one that we discussed there, would correspond to taking, like in effective field theory as well, right? Taking the scale in length, for example, length scale, which is much larger than a microscopic scale describing the microscopic sort of interactions of your theory, right? So in the language of kinetic theory, to which we can easily appeal, this microscopic scale would be set by the mean free path. So in order to have some notion of local thermal equilibrium, you need to look at the boxes inside your gas, for example, so that the length of this box would be much larger than the mean free path between your constituents, right, the microscopic constituents, because otherwise you don't have a notion of local equilibrium, right? So if you have one molecule here and one molecule here and there, right, so they change all the time, right? So it's not, you cannot average over free particles, right? So you can average over sufficient. So if you have a notion of mean free path, then the Hydro approximation would correspond to taking the length scale, which is much larger. So your length scale L must be much larger than, let's say, mean free path. It should be also much smaller than the size of the system, because otherwise you will have this boundary effect, right? You can have fluid dynamics in the bathtub, right? But then if the length scale of these waves is of the order of bathtub, then things will depend on boundary conditions very much, right? So this inequality must be satisfied. And a similar inequality for time scale, right? So time scale should be much larger than the mean free time, and much smaller than the lifetime of your system, right? Obviously, lifetime of system. Okay. Now the difficulty with that. So this is all fine, except that mean free path and mean free time are characteristics of a particular type of a system, namely the one which has the kinetic regime. So you can actually meaningfully say what this mean free time is. Many systems don't have it. I mean, if you look at system without kinetic regime, like fluids and so on, right? Then you may ask, okay, so what is on this side? And this is an interesting question. So, but typically there will be some scale in space and time that would characterize this failure of the hydrodynamic approximation. And this is a rather non-trivial question because it's not obvious in strongly interacting system. Sometimes it's quite obvious that hydro works actually down to very, very small scales and even in the realm where you don't expect it to work, but it's still, I mean, it's at least kind of your calculations show that it works. But anyway, so this is at least philosophically, this should be clear. Now, if I translate this into Fourier space, then this would mean that in the theory, with no scale apart from temperature, right? So C of t, right, at finite temperature, not equal to zero. So t is the only scale. And translating this and that into the language of scales, that means that your q must be much less than t, and your omega must be much less than t, right? Because you can think of your so think of a mean free path, your L mean free path, right? So this should be something inversely proportional to energy scale, and the only scale that you have is temperature, right? There's nothing else. Okay, so this means that q, which is inverse to L, would be much less than whatever is inverse to this thing, and this is t, right? So that explains this inequality. So this is the limit. So if we are in n equals 4 superrank mills, so tomorrow we will do this explicit computation, right? We will introduce these variables, omega, let me call them W, for example, right, which is omega over 2 pi t, and a q, which is our k, right? Maybe I should, sorry, should write k probably here. Now, a k over 2 pi t, and these are, so this is magnitude of k, 2 pi t, and the hydro regime would correspond to the condition that these are very small numbers, because in principle this is just so what you can do if you can solve the differential equations of our gravity background and compute exactly these correlators, this one and this one, it will be some complicated function in which you take this limit, and then the prediction is that you must discover that your function has poles, this one, and this one. But as we discussed yesterday, you don't have to to compute the correlators. All you have to compute is the spectral quasi-normal spectrum, right? So in your tutorial today, and also tomorrow, so in the tutorial you'll be asked to take care of the quasi-normal spectrum of the Maxwell field, which is dual to this conserved current, and you will see explicitly the appearance of this diffusion mode in the quasi-normal spectrum. And tomorrow we will do the same thing for introducing some additional pieces which are very useful in general in holography. We will do the same for gravitational perturbations, And we will see explicitly the appearance of these, the shear mode and the sound mode. And that would allow us to compute the ratio of shear viscosity to the entropy density in the limit of infinite coupling lambda and infinite n. Okay, so these will be expressions, of course. You understand that, computing this and computing d and computing that from dual gravity would give us the result for these transport coefficients only in the limit of infinite coupling and infinite n. In general, these coefficients are series or complicated functions of lambda and n, and it's a non-trivial thing. So you can do this computation, for example, in weakly interacting theory, and compare with a strongly interacting one, and that has been done actually. Okay, so we'll continue tomorrow with this computation, and we will finally extract our transport coefficients tomorrow.